This is Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Kenken for Jane Lindholm. Hey, gardeners out there, we want to hear from you. What are you harvesting right now? How's your garden done with this summer's dry, sunny conditions? What seems to be working for you, and what's not in your garden this summer? 1-800-639-2211 is the number to call if you'd like to join our conversation. Again, that's 1-800-639-2211, or post your thoughts on our Facebook page. Charlie Nardozzi, VPR's resident gardening guru, is my guest today. And Charlie, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
It's nice to be here, Nina.
So first question, this, as I mentioned, has been a very hot, sunny summer, not much rain except for the past couple of days.
Right.
I'm going to throw a caveat out there. I don't have a big garden, but I do have lots of flower boxes and flowers on my deck, and I've been working hard to keep them watered this summer. For vegetable gardeners, how has the lack of rain and all that sun impacted what's coming up?
Well, there's a good side and bad side to everything. So all that sun means things have been growing very vigorously. I've never seen tomatoes as big as I've seen them this year, the plants themselves.
And my basil plant is going nuts.
And the basils are going nuts. And those warm season crops, if you're giving them enough water, like the melons and the watermelons and the sweet potatoes and all those crops that like the heat, are doing very well in it. But of course, the downside is if you're not keeping up with the watering, even though we did get a nice round of thunderstorms, I guess we'd call it. I'm not quite sure what that was on Saturday, but it just kept raining. We have gotten a lot of water recently. It's really not enough to kind of turn things around, especially this late in the season. So if you weren't watering back in July when we were getting those 90-degree days and continuous days of sunshine and dry conditions, you might see things like, first of all, plants just not surviving, but the ones that did survive, maybe the fruits are a little bit smaller, maybe they're dying a little bit earlier. It just doesn't seem as vigorous because they really need that water.
And what about watering technique? You know, we talk about you've got to water your garden and your plants.
Right.
Are there things you should or shouldn't do as you water? Are there better times of day to be watering?
Yes. So the morning is traditionally the best time of day to water. And I often tell people to do it first thing in the morning. But really, if you look at the plants, the best time to water is really later in the morning after they've kind of woken up a little bit. They can take up that moisture. They can really transmit it around to the leaves. And then the heat of the day will come and they'll be able to kind of withstand that much better. You don't want to water, of course, towards the evening because that's going to set up a situation where a lot of diseases can get started because of the moisture on the leaves. So watering in the morning is usually best. Deep watering is usually best. One of the things that I always see people doing is going out there after work. It's almost like a therapy. They've got the hose in their hand and they're just sprinkling away, sprinkling the lawn, sprinkling the flowers, the vegetables, whatever it is. It may feel good to you, but not so much to your plants. They really want a nice deep watering where it's going to sink down a good 6-8 inches or so into the soil. And if you do that a couple times a week, that would be enough in most cases to keep those plants growing and being strong.
The lack of rain has definitely cut down on the mosquitoes. I have noticed I've been able to eat dinner outside this summer much more than in previous years. It's been a lot easier to get out and do weeding and yard work. What about other pests, specifically garden pests? Has the dry weather meant we're seeing less garden pests?
Well, yes. We're seeing less slugs and snails, obviously, because they like those cool, damp, wet conditions and the real lush foliage, which in some cases we don't have as much of. So I haven't seen a lot of damage from them. Some of the pests came a little bit later this year, like cabbage worms, for example. I got a nice crop of broccoli, and then I was kind of waiting for the cabbage worms to hit, and they never really did. They're there now. They did come around, but they did come a little later. And then there are other pests that I have not seen in such numbers before, like the tomato hornworms, that are just kind of devastating plants out there.
What should people do about that?
Well, you just go out there, you pick them, and you drop them in a pail of water. Or if you have chickens, well, that's a nice juicy snack.
So if you don't have chickens, you just have to manually go out and look for them and pluck them.
So if you just have them here and there, and that's probably the situation in most home gardens, where you look at the top of your tomato plant or your pepper plant. They'll eat anything in that solanaceous family. And if it looks like something stripped it, your first inclination, like mine was, is, oh, deer is in my garden. Because it looks like it's up high, because tomatoes are up high, and it looks like they just munched on all the leaves. But usually deer don't go after tomatoes. Then if you look a little bit closer, you'll see this 6-inch long cigar-shaped green worm munching away. And it's big. If you see it like right up close, it's kind of scary. But it'll munch away not only on the leaves, but also on the green fruits. So if you're seeing damage on your fruits and you're wondering what's causing it, it's probably the tomato hornworm.
So is there anything you can put on your tomatoes to get rid of them, or is it just strictly pulling off the...
So as I was saying, you know, if it's just a few here and there, it's just good to go out every day and look for them and pull them off. If you have a lot of them, there are sprays you can use. There is, in fact, an organic spray called Bacillus thuringiensis, BT.
Wow.
That's a big name, isn't it? It goes by It goes by the trade names of Thuricide and Dipal. It's an organic pesticide that kills just insects in that Lepidoptera or caterpillar family. So it goes after the cabbage worm, for example, and this version will kill the tomato hornworm as well.
I want to go back to this sun issue because this is something that I have noticed with my flowers. In the spring, I bought full sun flowers to plant in my flower boxes and to put on my deck. They have loved the sun, but I've noticed they're really looking a little tired, a little faded.
Yes.
And I'm wondering, you know, do you need to pull flowers, give them some shade time, or what should I be doing to kind of rejuvenate them?
Yeah, if it's getting like that stretch we had was really hot and really dry, and you get the winds blowing too, especially flowers in a container, they're going to dry out quickly. And as soon as it just gets that critical level of dryness, then you're going to start seeing the plants are wilting a little bit. You're getting leaf scorch around the edges of the leaves. The flowers don't look as vibrant. So if you have situations like that, it is nice to kind of pull them back, especially in the afternoon, to a shadier spot where they can recover from that stress. Now we're getting into a time of year, though, that you'll start seeing that we're getting dews in the morning because the nighttime temperatures are cooler. So it's probably not as much of a concern now as it was back in July. But that being said, if you have plants that are stressed looking, and especially if they're trailing plants like the petunias, calibrachoas, scovolas, alyssums, lobelias, anything that kind of trails off, you can cut those way back. And you can cut one that maybe it's 2 feet long, cut it back to 6 inches or so, and it'll send out new foliage, especially if you water it and give it a little shot of fertilizer. And in a couple of weeks, you'll have almost like a new plant that you can enjoy right into the fall.
All right. Good to hear. Marissa posted on Facebook, speaking of flowers and flowering bushes, I have 4 healthy, very green hydrangea bushes that have no flowers at all. They did not blossom last year either. How do I get these otherwise healthy-looking bushes to produce flowers?
Yes. Yeah, so she probably has the mophead hydrangea, which is that blue hydrangea that you've probably seen around, especially if you go down to southern New England, New Jersey, Pennsylvania. It's just Cape Cod is famous for them. You
see them all over. Kind of look like snowballs, blue snowballs.
Big blue balls, blue snowballs, exactly. So they usually flower on the old wood. And about, I'd say 10, 15 years ago, there's a company out in Minnesota, Bailey's Nursery, developed one that flowers not only on the old wood, but the new wood. It was like a big revolution in growing hydrangeas in colder climates. They called it the Endless Summer Hydrangea. And it was really touted as being the solution for people who want to grow blue hydrangeas in the north, because even if the old growth dies back, the new growth that comes up in the spring will still form flowers. So a lot of people planted it, and they're all over the place. And now it's got the nickname or reputation as being the Endless Bummer hydrangea because of this situation, meaning that they just don't flower. So there's a couple reasons. Other than that, they're a beautiful green plant. So there's a couple reasons why it's happening. First of all is if that old growth does die back in the winter, the new growth that comes up sometimes takes a long time to flower. I've had ours sometimes flowering in September, even October. And you look at it, it's like, now? After all of this time, you're going to flower? So the key is to make sure that old growth survives the winter. So looking forward to like Thanksgiving, early December, that time of year, what you can do is get some wood chips or bark mulch and bury the crown of the plant. So about 1 foot deep, just bury it with this mulch. Leave the stems that are above that just hanging out. That's fine. You don't have to bury everything. But you do want to protect the base of those stems so that they survive the winter. Then in the spring, you pull back that mulch, probably in April or early May, and let those buds on that, those stems that survived form the stems, and then they'll form flowers earlier than the ones that will come out of the ground. So what happened this year, because I have the same issue, we only have a couple flowers on ours, I pulled it back, but I pulled it back too early. And we got a cold snap, I think in early May, if I remember right. And it probably killed some of those buds, and therefore I had to wait. So that's one issue. And the other issue is don't fertilize with nitrogen around them, especially if you have lawn. And if you're fertilizing with lawn, it'll leach out and it'll cause this big, bushy green bush, but not much flowering.
All right. Well, so Marissa, there is hope, but you'll have to do a little effort later this fall.
Yes.
Listeners, we're talking about gardening with our resident expert, Charlie Nardozzi. If you have a question or a comment to share, 1-800-639-2211 is the number to call. Or you can post your thoughts on our Facebook page or at vpr.net/Vermont Edition. James in Randolph also posted on Facebook. He had another flowering question for you. Mm-hmm. He said, I planted 4 eggplant plants, and although they look healthy, none have flowered. Why?
None have flowered. Yeah. Wow. So eggplants are another one that likes warm conditions. But this year has not been a problem. In fact, it's been a banner year for eggplants in a lot of gardens. So I'm guessing that maybe what might have happened is, going back to what I just said about hydrangeas, he got too much nitrogen in the soil, maybe too much compost manure, just a very fertile, rich soil. And when that happens, what plants will do is they'll send up a lot of leaves, because that's what the nitrogen feeds the leaves, but it creates an imbalance in the plant so that the nutrients that they need to flower and fruit are not plentiful or available. And so it'll take a while for them to come around. So I wouldn't give up on the plants, but we are getting to mid-August here. So he's in Randolph, I think you said. So it can also be pretty chilly down there pretty soon.
Right.
So he might just kind of keep an eye on them. If you get some flowers, cover them over with a floating row cover so that he can extend the season a few more weeks, and maybe he'll get a few little eggplants this year.
Andrew in Killington posted on our Facebook page, "My question is about American bamboo or Japanese knotweed." Mm-hmm. Said, "I have one large patch and now it's sprouting up around my property and other areas. I've cut it down, pulled it up by the roots, and it keeps coming back. How can I get rid of this?" he writes.
Oh, it's one of those tough ones. There's a whole handful of weeds that we have that are kind of like that. The Japanese bamboo, the gout weed or bishop's weed, a horsetail is another one. They all have the same modus operandi, meaning that they can spread by their roots. And if you pull them out from their roots, and if you leave a little piece of root in the ground, they will just keep sprouting up. So you have to be more diligent, tougher, and more tenacious than the actual plants. And the way to do that is to go after where they're spreading and either cover it over with black plastic, or some people have used cardboard, something that's going to kind of shade that area or block that area so it doesn't come up, and then leave it like that for about a year or so. Then pull that off, and then you'll see the stems will still come up, but by then they're so weakened that you can probably pull them out. But even after that, year after year, you're going to have to stay on top of it because it's going to want to reinvade.
So it is not a quick fix.
There is no quick fix to it, yeah. And once you've freed an area of these weeds, if you can put down some edging pretty deep into the soil, a foot or, for Japanese bamboo, a couple feet down, that will stop it from encroaching from other wild areas back into your garden.
All right, listeners, if you're just tuning in, again, we're talking about gardening with our resident gardening guru, Charlie Nardozzi. Maybe you have a question about what's going on in your garden. You can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Let's go to the phones and take a call now. Sebastian is calling in. Hi, Sebastian. Welcome.
Hi. I have a quick question. My question is, I'm a chairperson for our local arts committee, and we have an old Christmas tree in front of the building that needs to be moved to a new location right around the corner from the building. Mm-hmm. So what I was wondering is, what would be the best time of year to do that? We live way in the night. We live in Montgomery Center, so it's very cold here all winter, and the summers are very, very mild and cool, too.
Yes, Montgomery is a beautiful place. I've spoken up there a number of times. So moving a big spruce tree like that, first of all, it's going to be kind of dicey if it's a well-established spruce tree because the roots are going to be all over the place. But if it is a big tree, if you can get someone with a tree spade, that would be ideal. I know there's some money involved in that, but maybe a donation might be in order for someone to come in. And the time to do that would be in the spring. So early spring, like April, May, maybe up in Montgomery, as things have thawed out, would be the time to dig it up, move it into its new location. If it's the kind of tree that is not so big that you could probably dig it out by hand, what you can do this fall is root prune it. So go around the circumference of the tree, right around the drip line, which is the outer edge of that tree where the water would drip down on the soil, and just with a sharp spade, dig straight down. And you don't want to dig out the soil. You're just kind of slicing into the soil. And what you're doing is severing the roots so that in fall and in early spring, all those roots that have been severed will react just like a branch would react and send out side shoots and create a little root ball there so that when you do, in fact, move it next April or May, it'll be more likely to survive. Once it's moved, keep it really well watered next year.
All right. Great suggestion. Thanks for the call. Let's go back to the phones now and talk to Michelle, who's calling from Queensbury, New York. Hi, Michelle. Welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you. Thank you. Hi. Well, I tend to buy every year rue, R-U-E. Mm-hmm. And she's beautiful. I don't know exactly where she comes from, but I'm from Peru and we grow this plant. But anyway, I buy it. By the end of the summer, she tends to get this tiny little like butterflies, minuscule, and then they start propagating all over her and she starts looking yellow. I try to one by one looking under the leaves, there's the eggs that I killed, but they're faster than me, obviously. Mm-hmm. So I'm and then she doesn't look good anymore. And then I try no matter what, but these guys just take over the room, and I don't know what to do.
So, Michelle, let me throw that question to Charlie. It sounds like she's having trouble with little, what are these
little caterpillars. Yeah, it sounds like little caterpillars on her roux. It could be something in that the hornworm family I mentioned before, the Lepidoptera family. So what you could do is what she's doing, which is crushing the eggs. Look on the underside of the leaves and try to crush those. You can also try that spray I mentioned for hornworms, the BT or dipel thuricide. If it's in that family, that caterpillar family, Lepidoptera, then it will kill it. But there is also little worms that are in other families of insects that it will not kill, which are called the sawflies. So it's really going to be kind of a matter of trying to figure out which one. If you see seeing little butterflies flying around, it's probably in that Lepidoptera family. So the BT or dipel or thuricide should work for it.
And I haven't heard of rue.
Rue's an herb. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, rue's an herb.
I got to get out more.
You should get out more. Beautiful little plant, and I'm glad she's growing it. It's not that commonly grown.
All right. Again, thanks for that call, Michelle. You can join our conversation at 1-800-639-2211. We're talking with Charlie Nardozzi. He's here to answer all your gardening questions, or maybe you want to call in and share some tips. Diane sent in this email. She writes, "We have some lovely Howden variety pumpkins that are ripening fast. Conventional wisdom says to wait and harvest them when the plants die down. They're still growing strong. Should I harvest them early or wait?"
Well, it kind of depends on what's going on in your pumpkin patch. So if there's a concern about mice or voles or any kind of creatures maybe tunneling into the pumpkins as they're ripening, because as you know, with pumpkins, once they turn orange and start ripening, they get a little softer, a little more attractive for wildlife to come in and start munching on them. If that's a concern, I would say go ahead, yes, and harvest those pumpkins. Once they turn orange, they're mature. So harvest them, leaving maybe about 6 inches or so of the stem. Put them in a cool place, a dry place, and then you can use them, of course, for cooking and decorating come October. For the rest of the pumpkins that are forming, and this is kind of true for a lot of these vining plants, you know, pumpkins, watermelons, cantaloupes, winter squash, you know, let them keep going for a little while longer. But when we get to early September or so, that's a good time to cut back the ends of the vines, because what you're trying to do is send more energy into them maturing the fruits that have already set and less energy into actually creating more vines and more fruit, because those new vines and fruits are not going to have enough time to actually mature. So you really want to mature what you have. By cutting back those vines, it'll hasten that pace of maturation.
Interesting email from BHA. Email says, "The new owners of the house next to us are doing a total renovation and are installing corrugated metal siding. Some of it is dark and some shiny silver. Their house is between 7.5 and 8 feet from ours. We have 5 feet to the property line. Is there anything that I can plant such that every window on the first floor in our south wall doesn't have to be a view of a quote-unquote industrial warehouse and still be able to walk from the front of the house to the back?"
Huh, that's a tricky one, because you don't have a lot of space there. It's only 7 to 8 feet between houses, and the property line's at 5 feet. You could try something tall and thin, you know, like the cedars or arborvitaes or some of the tall junipers, like the skyrocket and Wichita blue junipers are really upright, very straight, and very narrow plants. If you have enough sun, that's really the key thing there. You have to have at least 6 to 8 hours of sun for those to grow well. Those are evergreens, and so they would provide that visual block you're thinking of. But if you can't do that, if there's not enough sun or just not enough space, you might have to resort to a fence. I know that may not be the most preferable thing, but once you have a fence, then you can grow vines on the fence, you see, and soften it a little bit. And maybe your neighbor will enjoy it, too, because the vines will go on the other side, too.
The farm stands and markets are hopping with all sorts of locally grown vegetables. And I have to say, I love being able to buy corn on the cob on my way home from work. Listeners, how are your gardens doing? And what about your yards? The rain we've gotten the past few days has really perked up my lawn and flowers. They were looking pretty thirsty. Feel free to share your thoughts with us at vpr.net/Vermont Edition, or call us at 1-800-639-2211. Gardening expert Charlie Nardozzi is my guest today, and we'll take more of your calls and questions after a short break. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Keck in for Jane Lindholm. Charlie Nardozzi is my guest today, which means we're talking about gardening and yard care. If you have questions about how to maintain your lawn with all this hot, sunny weather, or how to keep out pesky groundhogs, maybe you want tips on what plants to put in the fall, now's your chance. 1-800-639-2211 is our number. Or if you're on your computer, you can head over to our Facebook page. Let's go back to the phones and talk with Brendan, who's calling from Rutland. Hi, Brendan. Welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
You bet.
This is a great show. Thanks, Charlie, for mentioning goutweed. I wanted to ask whether, a project that I've just undertaken might succeed. What do you predict? I've got a little hillside on which there's bishop's weed that runs between my own neighbor's yard and mine. I recently gutted all the roots from the section on my side and planted clover. The clover's coming in really nicely, Dutch white clover, something low,
yeah.
and nice. But you know, this likely, I think it has tap roots that can run fairly deep and also, you know, moves laterally. I'm just wondering, what do you think the prospects are for this little battle?
Oh, for the clover versus the goutweed battle?
Yes.
They might have a face-off, I think. I think the goutweed still probably would eventually inundate the white clover, because the white clover, like you're saying, is very low-growing, and the goutweed can get kind of tall. You know, it could get up 8, 10 inches, 12 inches tall, and it might shade it out eventually, too. So, unfortunately, there's not a lot that can combat goutweed and still be standing. Maybe Lily of the Valley. That's one thing I've seen. Oh. I've seen some people have landscapes where they have goutweed and Lily of the Valley planted together. Actually kind of looks nice, because one of the varieties of the goutweed is one called Snow on the Mountain. It's a variegated leaf, and then you've got the nice dark leaves of Lily of the Valley. So it looks good if you can keep it maintained and contained. So this person had them underneath a big tree, and then they mowed around it so it never really escaped into the yard. So clover is a nice thing to have in general in an area, because it does have those deep roots and it does spread laterally throughout the area. It fixes nitrogen, so whatever it's growing next to is going to benefit from that. And it's pretty aggressive, so it'll spread throughout an area. And one of the nice things about having clover in a lawn is that it'll keep it green during those dry periods like we had in July. So most of the other lawn grasses will brown up, which is a natural instinct, by the way. It's not meaning that the whole lawn is dead or it's something wrong with the lawn. That's exactly what cool season lawn grasses want to do when it gets too hot and too dry. They just go brown and say, we're just taking the summer off. We'll come back when it gets cool and wet. But instead of looking at a brown lawn, if you have mixed with clover in there, it keeps it green, it keeps it healthy, and it's a nice thing for bees too.
Brendan, thanks for that call. And you'll have to report in on the next gardening show and tell us how this epic battle turned out. Let's go back to the phones and talk with Barb, who's calling from Jericho. Hi, Barb. Thanks for calling in. What's on your mind?
Hi. All my squash, winter and summer, and cucumber plants, the leaves have turned yellow and whitish, and the stalks are all dying. However, I've had a good crop of fruit throughout the summer, and there are still fruit coming on the vines that have not died yet. What is wrong with my plants?
It's most likely powdery mildew, which is a fungal disease. You'll see it this time of year because I was mentioning earlier in the show about the dewy nights we're getting. So the temperatures get a little cooler, a little more moist. Powdery mildew will just kind of take off. And you'll see it on squashes, melons, pumpkins, cucumbers. You'll see it on phlox. You'll see it on lilacs. You'll see it everywhere. It's ubiquitous. It's just out there in the environment. And with the right environmental conditions, it starts spreading. So the key is to kind of jump on it early. And it sounds like it may not be that early in your garden, but it does sound like you have a few plants that have not been infected. And a couple of things you can do to help thwart it, or at least slow it down a little bit, is to do some sprays. So there's an organic spray that's actually a bacteria, Bacillus subtilis, called Serenade. And it you spray that on the plant, and the bacteria fights the fungus. That's kind of the new thing in pest control, is they're trying to use microbes to fight each other, you might say. So it creates an environment that the fungus, the powdery mildew fungus, doesn't like, and so the leaf doesn't get infected. You can either purchase something like that locally, or you can use baking soda. So you get a tablespoon of baking soda, maybe put a little couple dashes of liquid soap in there, and a quart of water. You mix it all up and you spray it. And what it does is the baking soda changes the pH on the leaf so that the fungus doesn't like that leaf and it doesn't get infected. But it only works as a preventive. So you have to do that as a way to prevent it from spreading. It really won't help your plants that are already infected with the mildew.
Ooh, let's go to Andover now and check in with Kyle. Hi, Kyle. Welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hi. How are you?
Well, thanks. Thanks for calling.
I kind of have a bizarre thing going on one of my tomato plants.
Mm-hmm.
It's a husky red cherry, and it started growing another kind of tomato.
Oh, really?
Along with the cherry tomatoes. It looks like heirloom tomatoes.
Really? So on the same plant, just one branch is like an heirloom and the others are the cherries?
They're even sharing one of the stems.
Wow.
That is very odd. I've never really heard that before. Because sometimes these aren't grafted varieties, are they? You have grafted tomatoes?
Oh, I don't think so.
Okay, they're probably just regular
ones. I don't
know. Yeah, they're grown from seed. You're probably just seeing some aberration, some sport that will happen on any kind of fruiting plant, and maybe it's related to the heat and the drought and everything this summer that's causing it to kind of revert back to its native tomato, which might be a bigger tomato. Because the Husky Cherry tomato is a nice dwarf plant. It's been pretty well hybridized, so it stays dwarf and continues to produce fruit all summer long. But maybe what's happening is that you're just getting some oddities, some little sport coming off. It's going back to one of its parents, and it's showing up and manifesting on this actual plant.
All right. Well, interesting.
It'd be different.
Fun to see a photo of that, actually. Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
Maybe even post it. Barb posted on Facebook, what about leeks? Ours are developing seed pods. Can we cut them off to keep them growing?
Developing seed pods. Huh, that's interesting. So leeks usually are a biennial, meaning that they will not form seed pods this time of year. They will kind of make it through the winter, and then that's when they form their seeds, where you can collect the seed and use them to grow more leeks if you like. So if I was seeing seed pods on my leeks now, I would probably cut them off, just like you would with rhubarb seed stalks that are happening, or even shallots or onions if they're forming seed stalks. Cut those back, because you're really trying to get the leek to be nice and big and chunky as possible. And anything that's sending up a seed stalk is spending more energy in producing seeds and less into producing a bigger plant.
Let's go back to the phones again. Go to Crown Point, New York. Check in with Frank. Hi, Frank.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you very much for the program. Hopefully you can hear me.
Yes, we can hear you
loud and clear.
Great. Hey, I am so frustrated by the invasive species of poison parsnip.
Oh, yeah.
It is just taking over. And I'm trying to find out what if any time of the year can I work it and try to get rid of it without the threat of getting severe burns and all that kind of stuff.
Well, for the plant, the best time to try to remove it is right before it starts flowering, or right before it sets the seed. So you can get it in the flowering stage, but don't let it set seed. That would be when the plant is most vulnerable, because it sent all this energy into forming a flower stalk and a flower. So if you cut it down at that point, a lot of times you will actually exhaust it, so it won't come back. But for you, that's not the safest time, because by cutting it that time of year, there's a lot of that sap potentially can get on you. The thing you have to remember about the poison parsnip is that the sap has to get on your skin, and you have to be exposed to sunlight to get those burns. So if you can go out there with the idea of controlling the poison parsnip and wearing long sleeve shirts, long pants, boots, gloves, just pretty much any kind of material so that you don't get any of that sap on your body itself, you'll be in a much safer situation. And then, of course, you want to wash all of those materials afterwards. But that would be the best time to do it. And if you can continually mow, brush hog down, so if you have a field of it and you can brush hog it so it doesn't set seed, and maybe even do it a second time, that will eventually exhaust it. It supposedly is only a biennial plant, but I seem to see it popping up all over the place.
Our neighborhood has done that with mowing our meadow twice a summer now, specifically to get rid of poison parsnip. And
right.
It seems to be making a difference.
Yeah, it does make a difference, because other plants, other wildflowers will come in and outcompete it over time.
Listeners, if you're just joining us, it's our late summer gardening show with gardening guru Charlie Nardozzi. Feel free to join the conversation by calling 1-800-639-2211 or post your thoughts at vpr.net/Vermont Edition. Lily emailed us about an invasive bush. She writes, about 4 years ago, we purchased a barberry bush and a burning bush at a yard sale. We realized recently that both of these bushes are not native to Vermont and are considered invasive. What would you recommend as the best action we can take? Should we remove both bushes, or is there some way that we can monitor them so that our plants do not endanger other local plants?
Well, both of those are invasive species in Vermont, and the reason is that they form seeds that the birds will eat, and then the birds fly off and poop them around in the environment. Those seeds, of course, start growing, and then you get more plants all over. So really trying to control the invasive in your yard. It's not the kind of plant where you can somehow do something so it's not as invasive. The invasiveness of it is because they have these seeds. So I would suggest if it would work in your yard and the plants aren't too big and it's not going to create too much of a disruption to rip them out, to take them out. And there's lots of great alternatives out there for burning bushes and for the Japanese barberry that can be in your yard. And it gives you an opportunity to recreate a garden. I always look at it as an opportunity.
Martin in Barton emailed, how can I ripen my tomatoes more quickly? He's got tons of green tomatoes. What can he do?
I like that name, Martin in Barton. So yes, as the tomatoes are, they're green now and they'll really start kicking in very soon. This is a time of year people always will send me questions about, Charlie, my tomatoes look beautiful, but they're all green and they're not ripening. Well, that's just because they have to get to that mature stage and they're just hitting it now and they will continue doing that now for the next month or so. Well, in Barton, hopefully for another month or so, depending on how soon the fall comes. If he's concerned about it, you got a lot of heirlooms that are really beautiful and there really doesn't seem to be ripening very fast as we're getting towards the end of the month. What he can do is top the plant, cut off the growth points of those tomatoes. So all those little new growth points, so any new flowers that are forming, take all of that off because that's not going to be helping your tomatoes ripen. And when frost is threatening, maybe as early as early September in Barton, you might want to throw some floating row covers over them to protect them for at least a couple weeks or so into September. And the combination will get them to that stage where they just start turning color. And then at that point, you can actually pick them, bring them inside, and finish the ripening inside.
Listeners, if you're just joining us, we're talking about gardening with Charlie Nardozzi today on Vermont Edition. Lots of callers to get to, so I will go back to the phone lines now, go to Huntington, and catch up with Dave. Hi, Dave. You have a question?
Yeah, so I went down to my garden this morning, and I noticed that my squash plants were starting to die, and I noticed all sorts of what it appears to be squash bugs on them. I was just wondering if there's anything I can do to control them.
Yes, they probably are. Are they gray like bugs? And the little ones look like the big ones?
Yeah, light gray, kind of like
regular
looking.
Yeah, those are all squash bugs. Those are what we call true bugs. So if you see the little babies, they look exactly like the adults, just smaller versions. And they reproduce like rabbits. So once they get started, they'll be all over the place and they can attack the leaves, the flowers, the fruits of your squashes. So the best thing to do, though, is to curtail the population by crushing the eggs. And the eggs are really easy to find. What you want to do is look on the back side of your squash leaves, and you'll see a lot of times where the veins are right in that crotch area, you'll see a cluster of these burnt orange colored eggs. Very, very vivid, very noticeable there. Those are all squash bug eggs. So if you can go through and squish them with your hand or cut them out, if you're squeamish about that, you can take scissors and cut them out and drop them into a pail of soapy water. But to really kind of curtail the whole population by killing the eggs, that's going to slow it all down. The other thing you can do is try to clean up any of those dead leaves that are on the ground, because squash bugs like to hide underneath things, especially when it's hot and dry. So if you can clean up dead squash leaves or weeds that are around or any boards or anything like that and remove that from the environment, then they'll be less likely to stay around that area.
Gardening expert Charlie Nardozzi is here with me in the studio, and we will have more of our summer gardening show here on Vermont Edition after a short break. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Kekin for Jane Lindholm. Charlie Nardozzi is my guest today, which means it's our summer gardening show. Lots of people lined up on the phones to call in. We'll get to those calls. Paul in Warren emailed, we have a large rhododendron that hasn't flowered in years in spite of being partially cut back. What's wrong and what can we do about it?
Well, it could be too shady for them. You know, rhododendrons, of course, are a famous shade-loving shrub, but it can actually be too shady for them as well. And if you have, especially if you have evergreens around, if you have spruce and hemlock and pines around that are casting a lot of deep shade, it may not be enough light getting in there for that rhododendron to flower. So take a look at the yard. If that is the case, you could do a couple different things. You could try to limb up some of those evergreens so you get more light in there, or you can just forget about it and plant another new rhododendron, taking the opportunity, of course, in a sunnier spot. Because we're so far north, you can plant rhododendrons and azaleas almost in full sun, and they do pretty well.
A couple more pest questions. Tanya emailed, is there anything that can be done about liverwort?
Liverwort. Well, I'm not sure there's anything that really needs to be done about liverwort. So if you have some of that kind of in your mulch or in the soil and around in, around the plants, if you cultivate it a little bit, that will kind of get rid of it. It'll dry out the soil. But unless it's really affecting the health of the garden, I wouldn't worry too much about it.
Linda emailed in, squirrels and or chipmunks are eating my tomatoes. This is the real pest question. Any solutions to that?
Yes. So squirrels and chipmunks, they're very plentiful this year. You might have noticed that. And that's probably due to our very warm winter that we just had. So the population was able to survive. And so we got a lot of them out there. That coupled with the idea it's been so hot and dry, they were looking for moisture. So they're going to go after tomatoes and melons and all kinds of other things. There is no real 100% cure for squirrels and chipmunks. You can try to change the habitat, especially for squirrels, meaning don't have stone walls or piles of stone or wood piles around or brush piles around, places where they'll hide. Try to open up the area a little bit. For squirrels, if you can try to put some kind of netting or something over your plants, that might help if it's really thick netting. The key with any of these creatures is you try to protect your plants before they're a problem, before they realize there's something good to eat. Because once they figure out there's something good to eat, then they're going to work extra hard to get in there. So unfortunately, there's not a lot of easy solutions. I have a friend of mine who sits on his porch with one of those water gun cannon things, and he shoots at them as they run around.
My dog just chases them.
Oh, you get a dog that chases them. There you go.
Elaine posted on Facebook, any suggestions to keep lily beetles away? I kill the beetles and the egg masses, but I can't seem to get in front of them. Is there something I should do in the fall to kill them off over the winter?
Yeah, that's a tough one. The red lily leaf beetle is one that attacks the Oriental and the Asiatic, Asiatic lilies in particular. And those lilies, you'll see they'll come out as soon as those lilies pop out of the ground. You'll see the adult red lily leaf beetle starting to feed on the leaves. And then the most damaging part of it is that it lays eggs on the undersides of the leaves, and they hatch into these little slug-like masses that are really disgusting, Ina, because what they do to protect themselves from predators is they poop on themselves. And so it's this poopy, black, slug-like mat. It's just disgusting.
Pull it out.
So anyway, the thing to do is, of course, to control those adult beetles, but there's no real easy way to do that. There's certainly no easy organic way to do that. If you can go out early in the morning picking the beetles as much as possible, killing those slug-like masses, what I've done is to put some plastic gloves on and just kind of put your hand around the leaves when the plant is small and just go up the leaf and just kind of try to pull them all the way up and just kind of knock off those slug-like masses. That'll help a little bit, but there, now, as far as sprays go, people have tried neem oil, they've tried spinosad, they've tried a number of different things, which will work to a certain degree, but is not 100% safe. So probably if you have a lot of them and it's really devastating your lilies, you might want to go to some of the other kinds of lilies that don't get that problem, like some of the taller trumpet and tiger lilies. They don't have the problem as much with the red lily leaf beetle.
Well, let me get back to the phone lines and take a couple of callers who've been waiting patiently there. Let's go to East Fairfield and check in with Katie. Hi, Katie. Welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hi. Thank you. Charlie, I have two beautiful, brand-new beds that I wanted to be all perennials, and then I got the perennials in, and in the blank spaces, I put in some nasturtium seeds. Not many, probably like three or four in one bed and two or three in another, and they have just totally overtaken my beds.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, is that going to hurt the perennials?
Well, if they're overcrowding the perennials or overshading them, you know, kind of enveloping them, yes, it probably will not be good for them because they're not getting the light that they need in the space. So feel free to cut back your nasturtiums. They are a weed. In places like California, they're a perennial and they're a weed out there and they just grow everywhere. And of course, nasturtiums are edible, so you can have a nasturtium party. You can invite all your friends and neighbors over. It creates a nice spicy pesto. You can throw it in salads, nasturtium soup. You can stuff the flowers. You can do all kinds of things with nasturtiums. So yes, I would cut them back.
I would just come for the mystery of that, just throwing that out. There's a nasturtium party.
A nasturtium party. Yeah. Find out what they're doing.
All right, let's go back to the phones and talk to Kyle, who's calling from Albany. Hi, Kyle. You have a question for Charlie?
Hi, Charlie. How's it going?
Going well.
I'm calling about, I'm having some issues with rabbits this year.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of piggybacking off what we were talking about before with the other squirrels and such. So I was wondering if you had any advice for rabbits.
Yeah, the best thing for rabbits is a good fence. They're not the smartest thing, the old expression, a dumb bunny, is really true, because rabbits are not the smartest little creatures out there. So if you could put a fence around your garden, it doesn't even have to be a tall fence. It could be maybe 3 feet tall. Just make sure that the spaces, the wire spaces, the holes in the fence are small, because baby bunnies in particular can squeeze through small little spaces. And then once they get in your garden, it's just like a smorgasbord. And that happened to us last year. We got a baby bunny got stuck in our garden. He was in there when he was small. He got too big to get back out. And he just had a great time all summer just munching away. And eventually we opened the gate and he just ran out at one point. So putting a nice fence around the garden probably be the easiest thing to keep rabbits away.
Amy emailed in this question. She said, my question is regarding a root cellar. We have an abundance of wonderful root vegetables, and I have no cellar. I don't have a basement and do plan to build a bank root cellar next year when we've got more time, but I need help for this winter. She says, I tried a metal trash can with holes for drainage, straw, insulation, etc. last winter, but ended up having frozen veggies, no doubt an error on my end. I'm curious if you have any suggestions for a temporary root cellar.
Yeah, so for some crops, like carrots, for example, and parsnips, you can just leave them in the ground. So you can put them in the ground and let them grow, let them mature. And then come November or so, get some hay mulch or straw mulch and put a big pile of it on top of that bed. So big by like 2-3 feet worth of pile of hay or straw on top of it. That will insulate that bed enough so you can go back in January, February, dig through the mulch, dig through the snow, and actually be pulling out carrots and parsnips. So it'll actually be really nice and tasty that way. So that's one way to overwinter those. Other things like pumpkins and winter squash, they don't really need cold temperatures. So if you have a cool room in the house, a closet area or a little hallway area, or I'm trying to think of what else you can have in a house. Mudroom, that was the word I was trying to come up with. Some area that stays cool, like 50 degrees, they actually will do well in that conditions. You know, those winter squash and pumpkins kind of like those 50 degree temperatures with some humidity. So you can actually store some of those in there. So getting creative about where you're storing things might be a nice way to get through this winter so that by next year, when you do have an official root cellar, you'll be all ready to go.
Charlie, but I want to ask you about kind of on a different topic a little bit, same gardening topic, but you are working on a special project that is getting veterans into gardening, into the Burlington area. And I want to make sure we talk about that
today
in the
thank
program.
You.
It sounds really interesting.
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. I'm working with a couple of different local groups in the Chittenden County area. One is HANDS, who works a lot with seniors, and they're doing a number of different gardening programs with St. Michael's College and with the Vermont Community Garden Network. And so these three groups have gotten together, and they have started a couple of different sites where they've invited veterans to come out and do gardening. And what we have found is that getting veterans out in the garden is just an amazing experience, because a lot of these guys, and these are older veterans as well as younger veterans, a lot of these guys, you know, have a history of gardening or have a kind of a connection with the earth, but because of where they're living or their life situation, they just don't have a chance to do this. So we have a site up at St. Michael's where we're collaborating with them. And every week, or every 2 weeks, I go up and do some classes, but then we've set it up so that every couple days, some veterans go down there and they're watering, they're weedering, they're harvesting. And it's just amazing to watch the transformation in some of these veterans. You know, just they start talking about their past and growing things, and they're so amazed when the beans are there and the zucchinis and the tomatoes. So we're doing a site at St. Michael's and also a site in Winooski at a COTS homeless shelter that has veterans in it as well. That's a smaller garden, but the same kind of experience is happening. And not only are they providing some fresh food for the veterans, but it's also a nice social environment.
And are there any plans to expand it beyond Chittenden County? Is it working so well that you're thinking, hey, maybe we should?
Yeah, of course, it always depends on funding. But yes, there has been some discussion about some of the other senior housing facilities around the state and other possibilities. It's just such a natural connection, having veterans in the garden producing food and just kind of talking with each other and being more social. And it's really kind of a nice healing process, too.
And I think we have time for one more question. Judy in Winooski emailed, what can I do about locust tree seedlings that pop up in my yard, presumably spreading by underground roots from a neighboring yard? I must have pulled up 3 dozen this summer, and boy, do they grow fast.
Yes, they do grow fast. Yeah, unfortunately, there's not a lot you can do other than get rid of that locust tree. So if you can keep mowing them down, cutting them down, just be really diligent about it. Try to do it earlier in the season. That might slow it down a little bit, but no, that tree wants to spread. That's what it wants to do.
Well, Charlie Nardozzi, I want to thank you so much. This hour has flown by.
It's a lot of fun. You should come do it again.
VPR's Charlie Nardozzi is our resident gardening expert. And I appreciate your time again. Well, that's it for today. Tomorrow, an update on algae blooms in Lake Champlain. We'll check in on the summer's developments and the health of the lake. Plus, we'll ask, was that an algae bloom in the Olympic diving pool? You can send your questions and comments to us on that topic at Vermont Edition at vpr.net and listen tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri, Sam Gale Rosen, and Meg Malone, with production assistance from Sarah Matthews. Liam Connor directed our program today, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. Grace Potter and the Nocturnal composed our theme music. I'm Nina Keck. Thanks for listening.